For Pennsylvania hunters and conservationists, our roots run deep. The episodes we bring to you on the Pennsylvania Game Commission's podcast, Call of the Outdoors, will take a deep dive into exposing the incredible work being done by agency staff and partners, including statewide habitat projects, the science behind wildlife management, and what drives agency decisions. The Pennsylvania Game Commission's mission is twofold: to manage and protect wildlife and their habitats for not only current but future generations, and to promote hunting and trapping in the Keystone State. Hello and welcome back to Pennsylvania Game Commission's podcast, Call the Outdoors. This is kind of a two-part series this month. It's the middle of deer season, and today we're talking about white-tailed deer, and no better to talk that subject with than our guest today, David Stainbrook. David is our whitetail biologist. I'll let you announce your official title, David, but we'll introduce you and tell folks why you're here at Pennsylvania Game Commission.
All right, thank you, Matt. So I supervise the deer and elk section. So we have our elk biologist and our deer biologist, and then we have several other deer biology staff that help through our program. And we kind of oversee some of the deer research projects that are happening throughout the state as well.
But we won't say anything bad about that Jeremy guy that's in charge of our elk today, because we're talking about whitetails.
Yes, just whitetails.
I'm teasing. But like your background, a little bit where you came from, obviously to get into the position you're in, you've kind of been all over the place, but you had to love whitetail deer, number one, to sit where you're sitting.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the things people said, you know, why would you ever want to study deer? It's one of the most controversial programs out there. But it was just one of those things I was passionate about, and all through school, that's kind of what I wanted to be. So
awesome.
Actually grew up in northwestern Pennsylvania in Crawford County, and most of my family's up in that Crawford, Erie County area. Went to grad school at Penn State and did a project with collaring white-tailed deer in Gettysburg at the National Historic Site there. And then after that, I ended up getting a position as in charge of the deer and moose program in Massachusetts. So I was there for a little over 9 years, and then a job opened up here in the Game Commission. Felt like a good opportunity to get closer to family and move back to Pennsylvania. And so I've been here for going on almost 3 years now.
Oh, wow. Well, we're glad to have you. And obviously, being from where you're from, even though you said you didn't travel much east, why would you? I mean, you live in the beautiful part of northwest Pennsylvania. But, you know, you understand, and you're right, it is a controversial, it is the most controversial species out there. But it's also probably the most important species when it comes to conservation. When you look across the whitetails range, the landscape, the amount of dollars that white-tailed deer put back into conservation, there's no other species that does that.
Yeah, I mean, state by state, white-tailed deer are the most hunted game species by hunters. So it's people are passionate about it. Both hunters and non-hunters are passionate about deer, and there's nothing wrong with that.
I mean, no, there's not. And everybody wants something different. That's the hard thing with whitetails.
That's the challenge, is balancing the opportunity. And as a deer manager, we need to be concerned about making sure there's not too many deer out there for what the habitat can support. I mean, that was part of podcast one, is focusing on the impacts that deer can have on the habitat that they rely on. And it's unique. Not many species that we manage have that type of a role where,
right,
if the numbers get too high, that they're actually going to negatively impact that habitat.
Yeah, you look at
too many squirrels in the forest isn't going to cause,
or too many turkeys, problems, which I'd be okay with, me if we, if there was a balance there, but they don't consume the habitat that white-tailed deer
do. Physical impacts, right. Yeah. So these deer are browsing on the very trees and shrubs and plants that other wildlife are depending on, and the future forest that those deer also depend on. So they need to have that. One of the reasons is we don't have that intact, natural system that was in place thousands of years ago, where the major apex predators were removing some of the sick and injured and some of the fawns out of the population every year. So we as hunters, as conservationists, we need to step it up and play that role.
Right. And we've sprawled out. We've populated too, and yes, taken a lot of that range from those animals. And it's a delicate balance, and by far your job, there's a lot of days where you're pulling your hair out because you're getting it from all angles. And I hate that for it. We're all just trying to make it a better place, is the bottom line.
Yeah. And we're all trying to do the right, the same thing here is keep our deer population healthy in the state. And that's one of the things that we evaluate.
Well, talking about that, you know, obviously the way that we manage the herd, and that is your, that, I mean, really when you look at your focus, it is, when it comes to whitetails, you're looking at, you know, we can break it down as far as we need to break it down, but overall, you're trying to manage the population of whitetail here in Pennsylvania on a statewide basis to the best available data that we have. And
yes,
like, you know, in the way to manage that, those numbers or the amount of deer an area can hold, or, you know, whatever you look at on the broad scale, is our antlerless allocation. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you look at how do we determine those in a, again, Cliff Notes version, how do you determine, like, if a WMU should have more allocation, less allocation, or the same allocation, if you will?
Yeah, so the first step is to figure out what do we even want to do with that population of deer in that area. So we break the state up into our wildlife management units, and that's it's a way to kind of break the state up into meaningful areas. We take into account geography, soils, amount of public land, and then use boundaries that hunters would know, you know, major roads, rivers, that type of thing. And then we look at the data from each of those units to figure out, are we okay with the deer numbers that are there right now? Or do we need to increase or decrease numbers? And so to figure that out, we look at three major goals. The first is to make sure that our deer population is healthy. And to look at that, we look at population trends. You know, so are deer numbers stable? Are they increasing? Are they decreasing? And then we look at the reproduction level. So we're looking at fawn to doe ratios. And then finally, disease. And CWD is one of those major ones. So we actually have staff out every year at butcher shops throughout the state, and we collect over 25,000. We collect age data from right. over 25,000 deer heads.
That's a lot of work.
It is, and we have, you know, wonderful staff that do that every year, and we really rely on that information to make informed decisions each year, to provide the best science to determine whether we really need to keep numbers where they are or
right.
decrease them. And then the next thing we look at is our forest health measures, and that was part of a previous podcast, but what we look at at the statewide or unit by unit level is data that's collected by the U.S. Forest Service, and they're looking at regeneration measures and they're looking at deer impact measures.
When you, let's just take 4B, because that's, and it doesn't have to be, reason that as a hypothetical example, because the only reason I say that is because I know that one very well because I live in it. So if you would take 4B and tell us what, you know, kind of high level, what you would go through to see if the you know, where you would set allocations for next year once you have all the data that you need.
Yeah, so that first step is to determine your objective for each of those units. So we'll go through, and this past year, the objective was to stabilize deer numbers right where they were in most of the units statewide. The only ones that we were had an objective to reduce deer numbers were two units where there were deer forest impacts higher than what was acceptable. And then the units where we detected CWD and wild deer in those units. And so there we would reduce the objective would reduce the population. So for an example, we'll take a unit that the objective is to stabilize. And we look at previous harvest data and we see that we're taking around 15,000 antlerless deer over the past few years in that unit. And it seems to be just enough to keep that population right where we want it. It's stable, and that harvest is getting us that. So we use that previous average harvest for antlerless deer, and then that sets the, you know, that target for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we have to determine how many licenses we need to allocate to reach that same harvest that we've been having over the past few years. And so then we look at the fill rates of those tags from the previous years. And so we see on average for most units, it takes about four licenses to allocate to reach one antlerless deer harvested. And so a simple allocation in that case is if we were taking 15,000 a year, we'd simply multiply that by four because it takes four licenses to reach that one harvest. And then, you know, we would see how that plays out and keep that population right where it needs to be.
I laugh all the time. And again, trying to keep everybody happy is impossible when it comes to whitetails, but we see it a lot, especially on social media. You know, I'm going to buy my doe tag to save a deer. Well, that honestly, that's the worst thing you can do, in my opinion, because you're going to have to allocate four more to get that number to where it's at. You know, I mean, when you buy an antlerless tag, you should really try to use it. because it's important for, you know, when we look at the future and how important, you know, how, just hit on it, if you will, and it's kind of off the cuff, how important is it for a hunter to harvest antlerless deer for the future of whitetails?
Yeah, I mean, so we allocate knowing that not everybody's going to be successful in filling their antlerless licenses, but, you know, it is an important thing to make sure that we're meeting our goals, we're taking enough deer to do that.
And we live in such a buck culture state. And let's talk about that, if you will, is you know, we can talk about the difference between buck harvest and doe harvest when it comes to numbers, when you look at like your buck harvest numbers, because you're not managing the herd by bucks.
Yeah. So if you go back to what does it mean if you take a female out of the population versus a male out of the population? So one male taken out of that population, removing one deer that year and one deer for all your future years. You take one female out of the population, removing that female and all the future offspring that deer could have over the future. So that's really why the allocation is so critical in how we manage deer, is because we're depending on those females to be harvested to keep the population from increasing if it's right where we want it to be. So it's really critical for hunters to fill those tags. And like you said, we do track the success rate. So if there's something going on, and that might be some of the reasons we hear some confusion from year to year where folks think we're trying to reduce deer numbers in a lot of units because the allocation went up a little bit. That's just simply, in some cases, the allocation may go up or down based on how those success rates are going and how that female harvest has been.
When we look at, and we're not going to get in the weeds on it, but we're going to talk about it because it's part of your program, is disease, CWD. I mean, obviously, you know, I don't care if you believe in it, don't believe in it, it's here. I mean, we have to face the facts. The country, across the country, it's here. We wish there was a cure. I mean, the only thing we know right now is, you know, we have to have that healthy habitat. We have to have that, you know, and lesser deer numbers in the areas where it is. I mean, that's the bottom line. Am I right on that one?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest things we can do as a state agency is to reduce the deer numbers in those places where we have found CWD and where we feel it's going to be over the next few years. And that's going to be one of the best things we can do to reduce the disease transmission. You know, fewer deer interacting with each other in the landscape is going to slow that spread,
right,
to put us in a much better place, you know, going into the future, and keep the healthy deer that are in those areas continue to be healthy.
That's all we can do. And it's really important that hunters understand that. To me, it's important that hunters participate in that. I mean, mm-hmm. We have a new, you know, DMA 8 this year. You know, it's brand new. It's crossed the Susquehanna River, and it's, you know, the allocation's been upped with DMAP, and, you know, it's, as far as we know from surveillance, it's not widespread, but it is in wild deer. It's across the river, mm-hmm. and trying to reduce those numbers. And I think the only people that can, at this point, that can help are our sportsmen, our deer hunters out there. And it's not just for the 23 season, 24 season, we're looking at long range.
Yes. And the other part of that is harvesting those deer and then, you know, providing the samples to our agency to track the disease is going to give us a better understanding of, you know, is this something that has just gotten there, or has it been there for several years and we're just now picking it up? Because that's going to mean a lot different, you know, as to how likely we are to deal with that.
Right. And it's, you know, every day science, you know, obviously we're creatives over in our bureau, so science is sometimes tough for us to understand, and it's just how it is. But every day the CWD is not just something that's sitting in a jar over here. There's constant developments, constant working on new programs. Mm-hmm. I mean, deer hunters, we keep hearing about CWD. We keep hearing about, you know, this, but we have to take action and try to help agencies, and we also have to try to help our deer herd, mm-hmm. for the future is the bottom line. And we can't do it right now without participation.
Yeah, and so when we put out the allocations, one thing I wanted to talk about was, in most of our units, we're able to take enough antlerless deer to continue to meet our goals. But one of the things we've been seeing is some of these units where we're trying to maintain that harvest or even try to increase the harvest to reduce those deer numbers, we're running into some issues with, do we have enough hunters out there to take enough deer to continue to meet those goals? And so it tends to be the units that we're trying to decrease deer numbers, you know, whether it's from forest impacts or CWD. And right away, we can see you know, two units that are still remain unsold, or they have not sold out, 2B and 4A. So those are right away, you know, as a deer manager, how can we continue to increase the harvest to get those populations to either to continue to stabilize them or to try to reduce deer numbers?
If you're not getting the participation, it's tough to do that. And we look at our, you know, I don't want to rain on any and be negative, but, you know, the age, our hunters are aging out as we're mm-hmm. looking at, like my age is, you know, pretty soon we're going to be off the map. That's why recruitment and getting new hunters involved is so important, because hunting isn't just a great recreation. It is a tool to manage wildlife. And like I said with Paul earlier on the first episode, we're living in the best of times.
Yeah.
I mean, when you really think about wildlife conservation, you know, when you can go out and chase a whitetail from, you know, in Pennsylvania, their seasons will start mid-September and end at the end of January, somewhere in the state, and pretty darn good chance of running into a deer somewhere. You know, it wasn't always like that. And I remember my grandfather telling me stories. He was born in 1903 and like didn't see his first deer track till I think in the 40s or 50s. And when they saw a deer track, it was like the big news of Lingolstown over here, you know, just a track. And to drive down the road now through Lingolstown, you know, they're pretty much everywhere. And I mean, when you think about that as the big picture and success, wild turkeys, same thing. Look at black bears. I mean, for elk in Pennsylvania, I mean, we're living in the best conservation times.
Yeah, and like you said, Pennsylvania is a very buck-centric state. And even when we look at our buck harvests, it's amazing where we are today. Prior to, you know, 2000s, when we were talking about in the 90s, we had some of the highest buck harvests, historic buck harvests. But back then, it was 80% yearlings.
If you had 3 inches of spikes when I grew up, he was riding in the truck. And I mean, you were proud of it, and I'm still proud of it. Don't get me wrong, but education has helped a lot about, and I agree with you 100%.
So where we are today, I mean, we over 60% of our harvest now is 2.5 and older bucks. So, I mean, there's a lot more older bucks out there. And when you look at our total harvest, we are taking almost as many bucks as we were taking, back in the 90s.
Right.
And so another thing is we had over 1 million hunters back then.
1.2 at the highest, yeah.
And we were taking pretty much the same amount of deer that we're taking today, with only, you know, we have about 650,000 hunters, so almost half as many hunters, and we're taking about the same number of deer.
Does that mean we're better hunters nowadays?
There's been a lot of changes from the Game Commission to continue to stay up on our antlerless harvest, right? So we've expanded opportunities, we've increased season lengths, that type of thing. So we've certainly been keeping up to make sure we can continue to meet those antlerless harvests. So we do have some record high success rates at this point. And but that doesn't mean that we're in perfect shape into the future. We need to make sure that we're still able to take enough antlerless deer into the future to continue to maintain these populations.
Well, speaking about that, and this might be something that's way off base, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and I'm not going to put you on the spot. But so I grew up hunting in the 80s, you know, in that place where a lot of people want to get back to, where they see 30 deer in a herd and mm-hmm. the last one is a spike and whatever. But back then, antlerless were monitored county by county. I mean, allocated county by county. And there was a lot of times we didn't get a doe tag. You know, mm-hmm. you'd send in and it didn't happen. And, you know, when we look at where we're at today, and you can put two doe tags in your pocket or two antlerless tags in your pocket, I mean, what were we doing wrong probably back then, let's say, or was the deer herd on an increase, decrease? We had 1.2 million hunters at that time, or, you know, over 1 million, and today we're still harvesting that same number with half the hunters, like you just said. What would you say, if you had a crystal ball here, and what the change is or change was and where we're sitting today? I feel we're in a better place now than ever.
Yeah, from a management standpoint, I would agree. I mean, back when we were managing at the county level, we were using a estimate of deer density and then looking at the structure of the forest in that area to come up with, you know, how many deer we wanted to have out there. So we're relying really on that one measure. Today we manage based on those goals. So we don't really, it doesn't necessarily matter how many deer per square mile are in this unit. What matters is it, you know, too high that we're seeing forest impacts? Is it too high that we have human conflicts, and are the deer healthy? And so it really depends on, you know, what that that unit can support. And from the size, I know a lot of hunters really like to go back, would love us to go back to a county level management, but you know, we would not be able to collect the amount of data that we need. And keep in mind, back then, we had to put together several counties to get the data that we needed to make those estimates.
Right.
And so we essentially were managing at that larger scale, but it was a political-based scale. Now we're in a geographic unit. Well, so it's a much better way to manage what was going on in that time frame. We were seeing deer numbers kind of on the increase throughout the 80s and 90s to kind of that peak number of deer. And we were also seeing some pretty drastic forest impacts.
I was going to say the habitat. And that's
what really led to that reduction in the population in the early 2000s.
Right. And I hear from a lot of those folks like John Zemi and you know, some of the folks that were around in land management back then is, you know, they're big advocates of what happened. And they said that's when our forest came back. I even, you know, even Paul and Dave Gustafson say the same thing in the early 2000s is when we really got there. And now we're, you know, kind of playing catch up a little bit and trying to keep it at that range.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've had the deer numbers kind of creeping up over the past 10, 20 years and to the point now where we're still maintaining stable populations and want to continue to maintain those stable populations,
right. But with half the number of people that are hitting the woods,
half the number of hunters that we used to have. So I think that's what we're trying to say is, you know, are we going to be able to maintain the antlers harvest that we need? You know, are our hunter numbers going to continue to decline, or can we stabilize it? And
we're going to do our best to stabilize it. The other thing is, it's still hunting, and you have to, you know, that's one of the things that we get so wrapped up sometimes. I mean, you still got to be a hunter. You know, people are like, you know, we talked about DMAP on game lands, and you know, you kind of brought up an interesting fact at one point in time. You know, we see some of those impacts on fresh, you know, forest projects or habitat projects, if you will. And those deer really don't go that far. They just get good at hiding.
Yeah.
I mean, they know when to stay away from people. I mean, that's...
Yeah, we've done a lot of research here in Pennsylvania with collaring deer, with GPS collars, VHF collars, and throughout a lot of other states have done similar work. And what we see is, you know, your average doe home range is about 1 to 2 square miles, and your average buck home range is about 3, maybe 4 square miles in some of the bigger woods. And what we see is during those hunting seasons, those deer don't leave those properties. They just know where to go to get away from hunters. And
you get a doe with a nose about that long, she's pretty smart.
Yeah.
I mean, she's been around, has many birthdays. It's just like bucks. I mean, the older they get, the smarter they get. And
yep.
And I just watched a show the other night when a guy that I respect very well, a deer hunter, said, you know, what they've seen, this is in Iowa. So he's like, when that deer hits 6 years old, that's their ghost year. They don't get many pictures of them. They hardly ever see them. You know, 1 to 5, they're, you know, they get tougher and tougher every year. But like year 6 is when that deer just, and then that year 7 is kind of like an old guy. He related it to humans, like laying around a lot, not as active, you know, doesn't participate in the rut. But they also get, I mean, over 500,000 hunters after you. Our deer get, they get a lot of pressure, and
they do.
We have to face that.
They know where to go to escape hunters, and those older deer that are out there certainly were doing something right for several years.
Yeah.
Interesting thing about the age, though, is keep in mind our bucks, they're putting everything they can into body growth from the time they're a male fawn until they're about 5, 6 years old. And that's one of the reasons why there is that myth about, you know, spikes as yearlings, you know, that's somehow poor genetics and we need to remove them. Keep in mind, those deer are putting everything that they can into their body growth, and whatever they have left over, they can devote to their antlers.
Mm-hmm.
So that their yearling antlers are not a very good indication of what they could be as a 5 or 6 year old.
That's a great point. I mean, I grew up on that wives' tale. You know, once a spike, always a spike. And obviously that's been proven. I mean, you could have a mature buck that's a cowhorn spike. I mean, it can happen.
And you can have yearlings that are, you know,
10 points.
Great. it's all mixed. But one of the big things is, like, we have to think, if that's what you want to see out there, some larger bucks, keep in mind, like, you need to provide the resources for them to get there.
Right.
And if you're carrying too many deer on your habitat that you're hunting, you're not going to be able to provide those maximum amount of resources to those deer there. So
that's a great point. I mean,
I think there's a real value in removing enough antlerless deer on your hunting properties to provide maximum resources for those deer that are there.
Yeah, and especially in Pennsylvania, I mean, we have a lot of ag. We don't have Midwest ag, but we have a lot of forest out there. Mm-hmm. And when they need 5 pounds of browse a day just to survive, you know, years like this where there's good mass in a lot of parts of the state, there's lots of food on the ground and water and stress. And I mean, habitat, it all plays into that whole game. You know, it everything is conducive. And, you know, even people that I know that hunt trophies in the Midwest, I mean, the folks that are very successful, they try to shoot as many does as they can.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just how they do it. And I said it earlier, I mean, doe deer bologna, antlerless deer, doe deer bologna and backstraps to me are a lot better tasting than a big old nasty 200-pound buck, but I'll take them both. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as an agency, when we look into the future, and please touch on anything you want to touch on, you know, we are out there in front of the public this year about how important it is and why we're issuing antlerless tags. What can we do as an agency, as sportsmen, to ensure the future of whitetails? When we look at, you know, all the obstacles that we're facing today in half the amount of hunters, we have a disease that's, you know, infiltrated mm-hmm. a lot of the state. We have forest issues and this and that. It's not doom and gloom, but we all need to be on the same page as we get into the next chapter, I think.
Yeah, and what we're seeing here in Pennsylvania is not unique to Pennsylvania. It's across the country. It's across the Northeast. We have a lot of states that they're battling right now how to continue to take enough antlerless deer into the future to keep their numbers from increasing, their deer numbers from increasing. And we are kind of seeing that play out in some of our units, not all, but certainly in some of our units, we're seeing that, have not sold out yet, mm-hmm. May not sell out, and we may not reach the harvest that we need to keep those numbers from increasing. And other units may sell out, but it's selling out in those later rounds where, you know, it's the same number of hunters, but now they're having second tags, third tags, fourth tags. And those later tags are, you know, less likely to be filled.
Right.
And it's less successful on those later tags. So, thinking into the future, if we need to increase the allocation to get the deer numbers down, or even just to continue to stabilize them, you know, can we actually meet
get the job
that?
Done.
Yeah, can we actually take enough deer? And so, from an agency standpoint, you know, we may need to look into expanding opportunity if possible, especially with effective means like firearms, to be able to meet those antlerless harvest into the future. So that might be something we need to look into. But for now, you know, there are tags available and there's hunters out there. It would be great if more hunters would, you know, take that opportunity to harvest that antlerless deer when it comes and not pass up on them.
Well, our biggest thing is we don't want folks to think you're rolling the dice back there, because that's not what you're doing. You work 360 days a year, 365 yes. days a year, trying to figure out how to keep everything in check. I mean, that's the bottom line. And we said it earlier, you know, we're sitting at the best days for wildlife mm-hmm. conservation. And for the hunting public, it's important. We all don't always agree on everything. I mean, you know, a lot of people, they'll have a concern or a complaint about that 100 acres they've hunted their whole life.
Yeah.
There's a bigger picture when we all, and I've been one of those people. Before I came to this agency, I had no idea how this stuff was done. And you're like, oh, you know, we're too many does. Well, there's with that formula, when you look at, I know we looked at a lot of numbers too. When you look at 67% of our people that purchase an antlerless license shoot 0 to 1 antlerless deer. Well, that's a hard number to put in your figures and figure out where we're at, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all have to stay more vigilant, I think, on these numbers and work with the agency and your staff and look at that information out there that's available to everybody mm-hmm. on where we're headed. You know, especially when you look at, you know, we talked about with Paul earlier, and you know, we're looking at habitat and we're looking at disease and, you know, the social impact when you get into the cities and things like that, where access is tough to meet those goals. And, you know, we're lucky in this state to have so much public opportunity. And I think if everybody just took a page deeper into the book, they would understand and we would all become closer in trying to get those goals.
Yeah. So you mentioned all of the stuff is available to the public. I forgot to mention all the goals, objective, and data that we use. It's all transparent. We have that on our deer page on the website. And if you look at our most recent allocation summary, it goes through all of that. You can go flip back to the back the document and you look at unit by unit the data that we look at that leads to the decisions that we're making for how many to allocate.
Right. And I encourage all of our hunters out there, if you get a survey, answer it, get involved. We manage the wildlife in this state. We're entrusted to manage it for the population, the people of the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. We're all in this together. We might ask for your help once in a while, whether it's shooting an antlerless deer or, you know, reporting your harvest, taking the survey, but that stuff's all important to this agency as we go in the future. David, we take our hat off to you for everything you do. Anything that you'd like to say before we, it's about time to get in the stand. So, you know, anything you'd like to say to the folks out there that how they can help or anything that comes to mind?
I really appreciate everyone out there enjoying the hunting season, being willing to take deer, and we have all the stuff available to be able to show, you know, how we manage, and you know, we're not going to see deer populations decrease and not do something about that. So we will adjust accordingly on the analyst allocation side. But another thing that could be an issue for some hunters is that willingness to take an additional deer if they don't really like venison or they can't eat enough venison. One deer is enough for them, for their family. Keep in mind, there are a lot of other folks out there that would, you know, love to have deer meat and venison donated. We have Hunters Sharing the Harvest programs throughout the state that deer could be donated free of charge.
Which is a great
please
program.
Take advantage of
absolutely
those. Find out if your neighbors, if there's other hunters out there that didn't fill a tag that would love some venison, find out about that. Find out at local sportsman's clubs. And then hopefully by doing that, we can have more of those or fewer of those passed up opportunities on antlerless deer take place and help us into the future to meet our goals.
That's a great point. The Hunter Sharing the Harvest program is a great initiative. We're heavily involved with them, and mm-hmm. it costs the sportsman nothing to make sure that, and I forget how many millions of pounds of venison that was provided to folks that in need last year. It's awesome, and it's a great way for those deer management tools. And like you said, you're not throwing darts at a wall. Or, you know, if folks out there have some questions, the best way to do is we all get involved together. You know, yeah. And throwing rocks doesn't solve any problems. We all have a common goal, and the common goal is to leave it better than we found it. But David, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Call the Outdoors. I know that you've been out in the tree stand, and best of luck to you the rest of the fall.
Thank you.
Absolutely.